online. Do it. Tell a friend. And if you have the ability to do that, we will greatly appreciate your efforts. With that said, stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
Now? Oh, okay. Here I am. It's 8 o'clock. I'm sorry. No, it's 7 o'clock. I'm ahead of myself. It's WBAI New York. It's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope the thunder's good, but then you know.
The Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle. The microphone is off again. You know, you put a switch on your mic, you turn it off every time. Try that again.
Hello.
No, stop it. You're going to break the switch.
Hello? Can you hear me? Come in.
We all hear you.
Come in.
We all hear you fine. And let's turn on the Skype people. And that always makes my voice sound different for some reason. Joined tonight, look at this. We're in the Coliseum. This is some kind of weird mode that that we're in now in Skype, where we're all, it looks like we're all sitting together. That's really, whose bright idea was that? Well, when I introduce you, you can tell us. Rob T. Firefly, is it your idea?
Good evening. It was not my idea.
Gila, how about you?
It wasn't me.
Okay, a lot of innocent people here. Alex, sounds like something you would do.
Good evening from the Poconos, but no, seems like you may have accidentally clicked on together mode.
Uh-huh, yeah, blame me. Blame the end user. Voltaire, you're joining us tonight.
I can neither confirm nor deny it was me.
Okay, so it was you. Well, welcome everybody. This is our last show of 2020, and I'm sure we are all very happy to see this year go into the history bins, but... You know, again, like I said on the show last night, COVID-19, it came from 2019, not 2020. That's COVID-20 might be something to worry about in 2021. Hopefully not, but I'm just saying there are a few more days left in this year. Well, actually, one more day left in this year. It can still cause some damage.
Well, I think we've learned a lot about mitigating that particular kind of disaster, so maybe if we get another challenge that's similar, we'll have learned some lessons.
How did we mitigate? By holding an election? That's how we mitigated that disaster.
Right.
It's one way to do it.
Civic engagement. Yeah.
Wow. Hey, any of you guys make it to the Chaos Congress? It just ended. It was called RC3. Which confused the bejesus out of me, because RC1 was the name of one of the rooms, and then RC2 was another room, but the conference was RC3. But it reminded me a lot of Hope, because it was presented in a similar style, but they had a whole lot of tracks from all over the world, I guess, and they had a two-dimensional a place you could wander around and converse with people if you decided to turn on your camera and your microphone, which I didn't. Any of you guys make it over there?
I did.
You did? What did you think, Voltaire?
I think the 2D game was the coolest part. Just like you mentioned, that basically whenever you would get in proximity, like with a certain amount of pixels from somebody else, if you had this enabled, you, it would automatically turn on your webcam and your microphone. So basically, like, it'd be like kind of like real life, and that if you get close to somebody, you can have a conversation with them.
That yeah. Cool.
And you could, yeah, they it, and it's, they open source all this code, and you can make your own. It's like a 16-bit type graphics.
It sounds like great fun. I just have this. I'm averse to turning on my camera and my microphone automatically, but I can see where that could be a ton of fun for conversing and exploring. I just walked around, and it was kind of cool because it looked like I was at Congress. In a two-dimensional style. I went to heaven for a while, floating around the clouds, and I guess that's where a lot of the volunteers hang out. But so the talks,
call them angels.
A lot of angels up there. I might have even seen God.
They had a really interesting news program they mixed in called the Herald News program or show
in between talks.
Yeah, and that was really interesting, and as you said, reminded me a lot of our efforts to keep people updated, because that's a big part of it, is getting information so people know how to use
right.
the world, or visit a page to find different streams or assemblies but to a great degree they had a promos and things. Mm-hmm. There was the Chaos Choir getting together and performing. they really went out of their way to try to bring as many attributes of the physical event, which these virtual programs are similar in a lot of ways as far as the information, but it's not obviously going to replicate the physical experience. It's just different. It's a little different. And if you prepare yourself, it can be a lot of fun.
Between DEF CON, HOPE, and the Chaos Congress, I think the hacker world really showed some imagination and spirit this year. And I'm happy that we were able to do something. I sure hope that 2021 will be able to go back to actual in-person events, and appreciate them a whole lot more, but also bring to the table some of what we've learned. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. I'd like to go back in time a little bit now, as we've been doing the last few weeks, and it's turned into a very popular segment of the program, where we, thanks to a couple of listeners, we have managed to restore our old 2600 hacker voice bulletin board system. We had messages on there that were in some archaic format, and we couldn't figure out how to translate them so that we could listen to them again. And now, thanks to that help that we received, we have been able to convert 4,000 plus, and we've been just kind of going through and playing some of the highlights. Mid-90s, I think, is what we're looking at here. And let's just dive in and play one.
Hi, this is Joe from Insurgent Networks. We're a new system starting up in upstate New York. We have a website that's going to be going up very soon, www.insurgent.com, and a chat network, an IRC network in the budding. We are looking for people who are willing to write articles for the website or help keep up the news information on the website current. People who might have boxes on the web who want to link in, or boxes on the net who want to link into the IRC network, and general volunteers all across the board for anything. This is an open system. It is trying to further the free flow of information. Any questions can be sent to me at irs-admn@aleph.insurgent.com, or pop by our IRC server. It's kind of slow right now considering it's fairly new and it's not publicized. irc.insurgent.com. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, well, I don't think the excuse of it being new is going to hold anymore. If it's there at all, it's quite old. I don't know if any email you send or any IRC connections you try to make will go through, but it is interesting to hear that kind of enthusiasm, you know, so starting off a new project. Any of you guys remember this? No?
I don't remember this particular one, but I with a heavy heart must report that apparently at some point this person lost the domain name insurgent.com, now is some sort of food industry outfit.
Wow. Okay, well, that's kind of sad. So maybe maybe they will hear this and think fondly back. And we're sorry it took us so long to help you publicize. Although, for all intents and purposes, the system did what it was supposed to do. You basically called into a particular telephone number, which I believe was 516-473-2626. We had five lines. People would call in, and they would have mailboxes on the system, but they, just like a regular computer bulletin board system, they could leave public messages that people could listen to and reply to. We have another one. Let's listen to the next in the series. Which for some reason is not coming up. I'm not sure why that is. Oh, you know why? Because I didn't turn the volume up on the computer here. Okay, so with the next one from the old 2600 hacker BBS.
Yeah, this is I3 from 416 with a message for Drax regarding the canned wires, the red, yellow, green, and black. Well, in most cases, the red and green are the ones that are going to be used with one another. Red is what the phone company uses to alert your telephone, in other words, get it to ring. Green complements that. It's called a tip. Red is called ring. Yellow and black are rarely used, but in case you ever want to use them, they're in most cases used for multi-line purposes to get, in case you want to add an extension to your house line off the existing line. That's just about it. iStreak, 416, out.
And of course, 416 is Toronto. This information, Alex, I see you're taking an interest in this. This is something that's still pertinent today.
It is. And what he was probably describing there was how to create something that was called a beige box back in the day. And still would be.
What was a beige box? What would that be?
A beige box is essentially a makeshift or homemade lineman's handset. If you recall from the days gone by, you would drive past a telephone company truck on the side of the road. You'd see the guy hooked into a big cross box using an orange phone, something like that, a big, you know, telephone company phone that he's clipped into something and using that particular phone. The beige box was just a replication of that lineman's handset. And you did that by taking your regular RJ11 jack, your regular telephone jack, cutting off the end of it. You had four different wires in there that he was describing. You had the yellow and the black and the red and the green. The red and the green, as he mentioned, was the ring and the tip. And what you would do was go to Radio Shack, remember when those existed, buy yourself for usually less than a dollar or two a packet of alligator clips, splice the red and the green wires so that you had the copper coming out, run them into alligator clips, and you had essentially, once you plug the other end of that phone into a handset, the other end of the RJ11 jack into a handset, you had yourself a homemade lineman's handset, the same thing that the telephone company guys would use, and you could do all kinds of magic with that. You could climb up a telephone pole, open up a crossbox, and clip onto, I think it was called a manual, that the cable and pair, if I recall correctly, and start using other people's phone lines. Every telephone line had a connection, let's say, on the side of the house where the telephone system would, well, the telephone lines would connect into the house. It's usually a little gray box with a special hex type of screw that was difficult to unscrew, but could be kicked off, if I recall correctly, pretty easily. And then you would just clip on to where the telephone line ran in, and you were essentially using the phone in somebody's house, but outside somebody's house. We had lots of fun with lineman's handsets way, way back in the day, I have to say. And it was very cool to hear him describe those very wires that were near and dear to my heart to this day.
And that is what you can do with old recordings that you discover after 25 years. Wow. I can't believe it's been that long. About 1995, I think, is what we estimated. Okay, well, this last one is certainly going to spur some passion. This is from somebody who is extremely passionate, I guess, about their craft, about hacking, about technology. Let's have a listen.
Yo, the cable freaker out there. I will tell you the best way to be able to get cable for free. You look at the bottom of your cable box, like it might say Gerald DPV7 or DPVBB, which stands for Baseband 7. And there are several cable companies or cable pirating companies that you can buy stuff through the mail order. You can either buy the box, which usually runs about $400, or you can buy what's called an activator chip, which goes on the outside of the cable box that your cable company has. And, you know, you can either use your cable company box or use a stolen box, whatever. But what this chip does is it activates the cable box. Usually on the Gerald boxes, you press F, then 1, and then you flip the chip on, and you have a little tuning tool, and you tune it to where it goes from CE to C0. All right, then you hit the F key again, then you flip the chip off, then back on again after pressing F1 again on your Gerald box. Some Gerald boxes it's F4. And within 3 minutes, it'll flip to channel 2, and you'll be able to get everything. All the channels after 54 are going to be 8 channels higher. And there are several companies that sell these activator chips. And all you do is look around and see what you can come up with. Also, the DSS dish, there is a card that's out that allows the DSS to get everything. There's several electronic companies that sell those as well. So that stuff is out there. If you know what you're doing, you can do it. Now, another thing to do is to get what's called a standalone descrambler if you have a cable converter that's not addressable that transmits channel 3. If your system is a Gerald system and not using BB, you can buy a Gerald standalone descrambler for about $130. The Pioneer descramblers, which is like the Pioneer Green, which covers all those Pioneer boxes with the authorized button on them, which basically sends a signal to the cable company telling the cable company that, you know, it's okay to go ahead and start billing you. What you do is you you hook that sucker up and with your...
Oh, what happened to him? I wonder if we cut him off. Maybe there's a maximum time. That guy was so into what he was talking about. Of course, virtually none of what he was talking about is still applicable today. But yeah, you guys remember the old Gerald boxes and the things he was talking about? Nobody?
No, but I have a question.
Uh huh.
Because I was thinking that was a whole lot of information, really, really quickly. Was there a way to access specific messages in the system? Could you go back to that and take notes?
Well,
or
not...
could you hear it once and try to remember?
Yeah. Well, we haven't gotten into that stage yet. With 4,000 messages, it's going to take time.
No, I mean back then.
Oh, back then.
Could you dial into a specific message if you wanted to get that information?
Because
like you can't print that out like an email.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the guy because he was downloading a lot. But if you couldn't write it all down immediately, there was nothing to do.
That's true. Alex, I know you ran the system for a while. Do you remember how it was set up?
Yeah. Yeah, you could replay that over and over and over again if you wanted to. Yeah, and just, you know, re-listen to it. And a lot of people would have this type of information as well as like their outgoing message on their voicemail box, right? That's where a lot of people had distributed information. Was through their outgoing message, essentially the message that you would hear if somebody didn't pick up the phone and it was an answering machine, right? Your outgoing message is going to contain a lot of information. And for the voicemail box hackers and people that would exchange codes and credit cards that were not on, that did not happen on the 2600 voice bulletin board system. But that was the technique. You would call up and they would read out phone numbers, calling cards, credit card numbers, et cetera. You might not catch it all the first time, so you would call back.
Hang on, Alex, hold on a second. We didn't do that. We didn't have credit card numbers or codes or any of that kind of thing. We were very strict about that.
That was not happening on the 2600 voice BBS, but on other, you know, hacker voicemail systems that were hacked and that did distribute these things. That's what would happen. Is they would distribute these through the outgoing message. If you missed information, you would just call back and re-listen.
Anyway, as I was saying before this thing rudely cut me off, with the Pioneer boxes that, you know, send that cable signal through the company, back to the company, there is a chip for those. However, you have to read the little six-digit converter ID number, which is just below the barcode. and the only box that that'll work on is that present box. So buying the chip for the Pioneer box really isn't the way to go, because you either have to, A, steal the box, because, I mean, you know, if you move, obviously you're going to have a different box, and then you have a $149 chip that isn't worth jack. So best thing to do is to get the non-addressable converter, which you can usually get, like the Century converter or the Panasonic, which is like $100, and then get yourself the standalone descrambler. Now, I understand that SA boxes, Scientific Atlantas, like the 8500 and the 8600s, all those and the Hamlin CR6600s are being obsoleted. Okay, they're no longer going to be making those, and TCI Cablevision has been switching over to Gerald's all over the place. So you need to find out if you're BB or not, and the best thing to do with the Gerald system is to get the chip, because the chip will work on the DPV-5s, the DPV-7s, the DPV-BB-7s, and the DPV-BB-2014s. So the Gerald chip basically is the best way to go. So there you have it. And I have been a cable freaker for quite some time. That's it. Have a good one, people.
Oh, my God. That's just so incredible hearing that. None of it is applicable anymore, but, boy, the passion certainly is. And, do people collect old cable boxes? I'm sure there's a group of people that do that. Probably none of us.
There must be somewhere. It was a fascinating hobby at the time, and as this person knew full well, because analog cable, back in the old days, before everything was digital, basically, when you get down to it, the company was broadcasting everything to every customer and everyone that was hooked up, and it was just in your box where the smarts were to decide what you were allowed to watch and what you weren't. So it was very popular to have, say, add-on hardware or other sorts of hacks to get around the limitations that your box was setting for itself. Nowadays, everything is like two-way communication, and the cable company knows full well what's going on in your individual box. But yes, I do remember the Gerold boxes, J-E-R-R-O-L-D. They were a very popular brand for these things, and a lot of fun to play with, as I remember. To go back to what Kilo was asking about, when you were listening to this, the voice messages were basically in threads there, and you would control this with your touch tones, and you would have basically, like any other forum, you would have a couple of different forums you could go in and listen to. And then when you selected that forum, you would hear, say, the newest messages first, and then it would go back through the older ones. And you could go back to the previous message, go to the next one, replay the one you're on. So it was easy if you had like a pen and paper while you were listening to this to write everything down in an info dump like this. And there was a lot of good info on it.
I've seen it repurposed for closed circuit systems, old cable boxes. Like you're basically kind of emulating a cable channel in your on site, mm-hmm. and then you can have those box that coax distributed throughout the site, and then a cable box then decodes each surveillance camera as a channel.
Yeah, I just want to remember how they used to work. I remember one of the first boxes I had, you had 2 through 13 on the top, and then I think it was A through J on the second row, and then there was a third row, I think also letters. Does anybody still have those boxes? Because the channels used to be lettered channels. I guess they didn't figure how to go above a certain number. So I remember in Manhattan, there was, I think, channel I. Was that the naked channel? One of the public access channels was lettered. The whole culture has changed, but it's really important to go back and look at that. I'm just curious if there are any technology groups that focus on this,
like a collection of sorts specifically for broadcast satellites and cable. That would be fascinating. I'm sure somebody's tried or pitched it as a cool spectacle.
Do you remember there were some channels that would print out announcements? It was just announcement channels, but they would print it at like 1200 baud, line by line, and there'd be a scroll at the bottom. There might be some kind of title at the top, but there basically it would print out, and you could read it as it was printing out. And that was just the announcement channel. And I actually saw a channel like that on Canadian TV not too long ago. That still exists. So they do still have the technology, but I found it fascinating. It brings back such memories. You remember last week we were talking about, we just mentioned Channel 11, and we got all this mail from people that also remembered the old-time WPIX programming. We were talking about the cop that used to host the kids' show. Here's one of the letters. I've been a long-time listener to your program, Off the Hook. Appreciate the information you and your partners routinely impart to the listeners. In response to your question posed during the 1223 show about the police officer hosted kids show, which sounds awfully weird today, that aired locally in New York City during the late 50s and early 60s. He attached a link to a site called TVParty.com, detailing the history of the show. It aired on Channel 11, featured Officer Joe Bolton. Joe Bolton was his name. I have pleasant memories of those innocent years and immediately recalled the show when you mentioned it on the air. Thanks, Rob, for sending in that clarification. A bunch of people sent in the same clarification, too. So there are people out there that remember these things. You know, you probably remember every TV channel had its own personality. Channel 11, they were known for late night, Odd Couple, The Honeymooners, Twilight Zone, and Black and White. It was, and of course, New York Yankee games. That was what they were known for. But I'm curious. I'm going to ask you guys just a couple of trivia questions. See if anybody is as fixated on this as me. Do you remember Channel 11? I'm going to focus just on Channel 11. Like I said, every TV channel had its own personality. Unlike today, where you get crappy channels that don't do anything except play infomercials and they don't have any local presence whatsoever. Channel 31, remember WNYC before? Another thing Rudolph Giuliani messed up, he sold that TV station to a commercial bunch and it was never the same. Channel 55 on Long Island that doesn't have any local presence whatsoever. It's sad. But Channel 11, okay. What New York icon did they incorporate into their logo? Anyone want to guess? Rob, go ahead.
I remember it well. They were the Twin Towers, exactly. Which themselves looked like an 11.
That's right. You had this guy. I don't know who he was. He was a guy with glasses. I don't know how I remember all this, but a guy with glasses who was looking for the perfect way to spread the word about Channel 11. And he's in the street, and in the background, you see the Twin Towers forming a perfect 11. And he's like, "Well, I'm this close to finding out how to say 11 to everybody." So yes, very good, Rob. And then there was two questions here. There was another slogan that they used. I don't know how to describe it without giving it away. Does anybody want to guess a different slogan that they used? No? All right, it was 11 Alive. They were called 11 Alive for a long time. Okay, finally, what newspaper was affiliated with WPIX? No? We all should know this. It's media conglomeration. WPIX was owned by the Daily News. Yeah.
The Daily News, it was the picture paper, and that's why it was WPIX.
Then how come you didn't say that?
Yes. I raised my hand and you didn't call on me.
You're not in the video. Oh, you know what? Rob is in the video, but you're not. There you are. Okay.
Oh.
Because
oh,
you're
I didn't realize I wasn't in a frame.
No, you're not. You're not in the. Yeah, but we're in a Coliseum.
Disaster.
I'm not in the Coliseum.
And now you are because you've moved closer. Well, Kyle, you're not in it either. No. I'm in it and you're not.
I am well out of it.
But we're on opposite sides of the room, so there's no way you can be in it at the same time. All right, so that's fun, and all that because we're reminiscing about past technology, and that's kind of amazing. That's kind of amazing that we still do that. What's this story I'm hearing about GoDaddy? What did they do this time? They're facing backlash after their employees received an email saying they were getting a holiday bonus. But it turned out to be a hoax set up by the company to test employees. Testing them for what? To see if they're going to burn the place down when they get pissed off enough? This email was sent out on December 14th. It came out. It came after employees had already been notified that they would not be getting any bonuses this year. But the letter said this: "Happy holiday, GoDaddy. 2020 has been a record year for GoDaddy, thanks to you. Though we cannot celebrate together during our annual holiday party, we wanted to show our appreciation and share a $650 one-time holiday bonus. To ensure that you receive your one-time bonus in time for the holidays, please select your location and fill in the details by Friday, December 18th. And the email featured a large logo at the top that said GoDaddy Holiday Party. The email was not an actual email. It was intentionally, well, it was an actual email, just wasn't, it was a lie, basically. It was sent out by the company on purpose to test employees to see if they would fall for a phishing scam. And, I mean, seriously? You tell your employees that you're not going to give them a bonus, which seems hard to imagine that an online company isn't going to do well in 2020. Okay, so you already did that. Now you're going to mock them further by sending them an email saying they will get a bonus, but only if they do something that probably they shouldn't do, like click on a link. And then you're going to tell everybody, hey, the whole thing was a big joke, and we're not giving you anything. You know, how about something a little bit more positive reinforcement-ish, like rewarding the people who didn't click on something, who didn't do something insecure, and not holding a bonus over anyone's head, because that is just cruel. I mean, that's so wrong. Voltaire?
You know, one of the many bad things about this is it...
Can you speak up?
Is this better?
Not much. Can you just speak more into your microphone or turn your volume up a little bit? I can't raise you anymore. Go ahead.
Okay. So one of the bad things about this is it lets management in security or... in IT feel like they're doing something about security when they're really not like the, instead of putting in sensible security controls, they just use this to blame things onto the user, onto non-technical employees who are always, you always have to assume that they've got non-technical employees, they're going to mess up, or even technical employees as well. But instead of putting on those controls, they just use this as to shift the blame around and amazingly it's their fault when they don't invest in, security.
Yeah, that itself too. But I just it's so nasty to do that to people to make them. First of all, what happened to the people who did click on the link? did they get some kind of scolding in addition to being told they weren't going to get a bonus? And then the people who didn't click on it, I guess they chose not to get a bonus because they didn't click on it, so you didn't have to tell them anything. Alex, did you have something?
Yeah, as somebody, as a lawyer and somebody who's also been a CISO, Chief Information Security Officer, you're always looking to test the efficacy of your internal controls and your security awareness programs and always looking to try new things, to fish your employees, find out who's clicking on these malicious links, and then give them some additional training so that will be another form of risk mitigation for you. But it is always really difficult to find a new hook, to find new bait for these types of phishing lures. And I think this type of insensitive phishing scam that's used to test employees, I'm afraid, is probably more common than we think. And I think a lot of security teams and a lot of IT teams in particular struggle with trying not to cross over certain boundaries while also trying to test whether or not their security awareness training is actually working. And some of this also, I think maybe it can fall on the fault of GoDaddy, but a lot of these types of phishing scams that test employees are run by third-party companies specifically to test whether or not employees are susceptible to phishing scams. And so the sensitivity or insensitivity of these types of lures and hooks is always changing, and something you really have to be mindful about. It was particularly tone deaf, in my opinion, to send out something when we know that employees are hurting. We know that people are hurting. We know that everyone is suffering, and it's the holiday season. Anyone could use an extra $650, especially from GoDaddy, whom we know has had, you know, quite likely a record year, especially given all of the domains we've seen registered about the coronavirus, et cetera. So, yeah, I think this is a problem, but it's definitely a push and pull between testing security and maintaining a semblance of reasonableness in the phishing lures that you employ.
Go ahead, Gila.
No, I'm echoing. This exact thing happened in September. I remember talking about it when the Tribune Corporation did this to their employees. Literally the exact same thing, and it happened right before we went on air, and I remember reading it out from Twitter, basically. But the insensitivity, Alex, I would say would even border on cruelty at this point when you say we can't do this. And then the fishing lures at the third party companies, but also often it's the third party companies coming in to say, listen, let us test your employees to prove you need our services. And I think the idea of teasing people in this way to make your company spend money that they've just told their employees they don't have is cruel at this point in the game. But also, there was so much pushback on the Tribune company in September. I can't understand how GoDaddy didn't pay attention to that and think this might not be the right time for this sort of thing.
Absolutely. Voltaire.
I think it gets back to what Alex said. It's the, and I've seen this at my own company. These services are outsourced to companies that specialize in phishing, running phishing things. So it's not like the company will be able to see that the pushback that the Tribune company got.
I think one of the risks is company employees beginning to not take things seriously. Like, you're really burning them out at a certain point, especially, I mean, maybe I'm not emphasizing the cruelty that was observed or pointed out as much, but it's more fatigue. I think they won't be as alert because they'll think, oh, it's just this other thing that's going to, you know, make me subject to some review or, you know, have some negative repercussions. So they won't look at anything, or they'll be a lot less alert for the actual occurrences if you're constantly being berated with this.
Okay, so they win the cluelessness award of the week. Here's another story, though, that is making the rounds. That Delaware computer repairman who went public with the sordid contents of Hunter Biden's hard drive, get this, he's now suing Twitter for defamation, claiming its content moderation unfairly branded him a hacker. Yeah, how you like that? He's suing Twitter. Because, and I understand as Twitter users, we are all going to be responsible. We'll have to pony up some cash if he wins. But he's suing Twitter because Twitter referred to him or referred to the material as being hacked. Now, if you recall, when this New York Post story came out, the New York Post was the only newspaper to print this. Nobody else wanted to print it. In fact, their own reporters didn't want their names on the story. So right away, there was a lot wrong with the story. But Twitter would not allow anyone to link to the New York Post story. I took great exception at that. I thought that was stepping way over the line. It's not up to Twitter to decide if a newspaper story came from a rightful source or not. If they think it was hacked, okay, that's on the New York Post. That's not on Twitter. They saw the error of their ways. They reversed themselves. And I think now they understand a little bit more about what journalism is, even though New York Post might not be the best place to learn that lesson. John Paul McIsaac's repair store was where allegedly these damaging documents were found on a laptop that was left at the shop in April of 2019. The emails alleged to have detailed Hunter Biden's shady overseas business dealings and are part of a bigger investigation. But this leads us to do something a little bit more in depth as far as this whole story goes. And, there's no other way to say it. Yes, John Paul McIsaac has been named Hacker of the Week by Off the Hook. Yes. There's nothing funny about this, Alex. This is, in fact, we've been doing this for a number of weeks now. We just haven't had time to mention it on the air.
In fairness, his name's been in the running for several months now.
It has. Now, why is John Paul McIsaac Hacker of the Week? You have to ask. Okay, first of all, he manipulated the media into talking about him when he actually hasn't done a damn thing. And that is what a lot of the hacker community is about, but getting some attention for yourself when you haven't done anything and just getting the clueless media to follow whatever you do. Or how about this? Telling the world you're not a hacker when everyone's already forgotten about you and really couldn't care less. We have been hacked by him. He hacked us. or getting the New York Post to print your story. Actually, that's the easiest accomplishment, but there's something special about getting them to print a story that even their own reporters didn't want to be associated with. But the real reason why John Paul McIsaac is Hacker of the Week is because he managed to get a lawsuit dismissed the same day it was filed. And that, Alex, I'm sure you can tell me that's something that does not happen very often.
It doesn't happen very often. And I think that there's two interesting points about this particular story, which really was crazy. If we think back to 2016, and in the wake of the 2016 election, because of the whole WikiLeaks dispersion of the hacked materials from the DCCC, ostensibly coming from Russia, of course, these social media platforms, Twitter included, changed their policies to prevent hacked materials, quote-unquote hacked materials, from being allowed onto their platforms and being used to spread this type of information. And so I don't think that it is reasonable to classify this person even as a hacker. What really this type of prohibition on the story and the information itself was about was that this guy was likely some kind of dope who had unwittingly come into possession of materials that were hacked, placed onto a laptop, put into his store, and then he went and gave them to FBI, Rudy Giuliani, et cetera. He was essentially used as a mule for these materials that were hacked. And then they got their way into the public. And that's the way that you would obviate or avoid the prohibition on hacked materials that these platforms like Twitter had implemented in the wake of the 2016 election. And, you know, more to the point, too, had the lawsuit not been dismissed, I think, sua sponte by the court, but for any kind of defamation claim, here's what's interesting. A defense to defamation is the truth. So what he would be asking for is an investigation into the source of those particular emails, right? And if those particular emails were, in fact, found to have been hacked and placed onto that particular laptop, then yes, absolutely, you know, it makes the point. But it also makes the point that not that he was a hacker, which is completely misclassifying what Twitter did, but it would have made the point, if that would have been proven, that he was a dope who then was used to disperse this material to various news organizations who then made their way onto social media platforms. So the whole thing was really just
be
crazy.
Careful about calling him a dope. He is Hacker of the Week, and he can cause all kinds of.
Well, let me clarify that until he sues me for defamation. You know, it's my opinion.
Hey, he's already in a courtroom, so he just has to check another box for that.
That's true, right.
Yeah, all right. Well, listen, we're running out of time, and I do want to focus on something since this is the last show of the year, and we're not on next week. We're back in 2 weeks. And also, we have overtime at 8 o'clock. Go to our YouTube channel 2600. And you can call us, write down the phone number, 802-321-4225. That's 802-321-4225. 4225 spells hack. Clever, huh? And we will take calls starting at around 8 o'clock for the YouTube stream that will be archived as well. But we're asking the question, we're asking it of you folks here, since this is the last show of the year, how do you think technology played a part in this global pandemic, and how, in turn, was technology affected by the pandemic? Who would like to go first? Raise your hand and wave it. Okay, Gila, I see your hand.
Thank you. Very exciting. I'm glad. So I think for me, I feel like I've been repeating myself all year, but the fact that we have been able to connect and the fact that technology has in so many ways managed to shrink the world where we're all in our own spaces. But, you know, even right now when we're all, most of us are together in the Hacker Thunderdome, this whole sense of virtual connection, there were virtual conferences, there were virtual schooling, there was virtual religious services and virtual holiday observances. And I think the fact that the pandemic caused us to really pivot and reimagine what could be, but, you know, at the same time, wondering then what will be going forward when we don't have to do it. And in some cases, we won't do it. You know, how are you going to keep them on the farm once they've seen the Hacker Thunderdome?
Yeah. Alex, go ahead.
Sorry about that. So I'm mute, you know, for your bingo cards today. I've got a couple of points here that I thought about. You know, and number one, going back to March of this year when things were really kicking off with the hysteria. And again, just a few points. The first thing that I really remember being, you know, really fascinating, and this was a story that went all around the world, was when using the DNS intelligence platform that I had created, we found a state-sponsored and live attack on the World Health Organization on the 13th of March that some people had then attributed over to North Korea. And then this was the beginning of, I think, a massive wave of cyber security issues that related to pharmaceutical companies, to the vaccine, to the World Health Organization in particular. And in fact, was what led to my relationship with the CISO of the World Health Organization, Flavio Augello, who was one of our keynote speakers later on that year at HOPE, which I thought was really cool. But right around that time, and actually shortly before that, another thing that we saw was really fascinating was this massive amount of activity, talking about technology, but activity specifically in the domain name system itself. When we started monitoring for coronavirus-related domains, just as hysteria was kicking off in February, this started off first with we would see around 200 domain names per day. Now, putting this into perspective, you think about something like the Super Bowl, which is coming up shortly, actually.
Oh, Lord.
You'd see maybe 5 to 10 to maybe 20 domains per day, but to see 200 per day about the coronavirus was insane. Then that kicked off to 400, then 600, then over 1,000. At the height of this, we saw over 3,500 coronavirus domains being registered per day. And now we're seeing the same thing with the vaccine. Not necessarily to that extent or that degree, but we're seeing about 120 domain names per day about the virus. And this relates to the companies, Pfizer, Moderna, BioNTech, all of the companies that are dealing with this, but you know, a lot of it has to do with news. We're also seeing.
I'm sorry. I got to say, GoDaddy really can't afford to pay its employees a bonus. All these new sites being registered constantly. The business they've done this year, it's appalling.
Yeah, that was the bit of foreshadowing that I made earlier. Exactly right. But not all of these are GoDaddy. I would say a good portion of them are. But yeah, again, about 120 vaccine-related domains per day, and what we're seeing is kind of interesting because a lot of them are clustered together. Like domains that could be used for misinformation about the dangers of the vaccine are being clustered together, registered by individuals, and then sold off to the highest bidder. So this is a really dangerous activity, I think, that's going to continue, and it's going to shape-shift with the news and really has the potential to be dangerous both in terms of cybersecurity issues as well as from a public health perspective. And the final point I want to make is really about, you know, what's happened to us as human beings. I think this work from home mandate and the isolated nature of our lives has really altered us perhaps irrevocably in the way in which we interact and we collaborate. I mean, the unremitting series of Zoom meetings, WebEx conferences, FaceTime calls has now normalized these screen-based two-dimensional relationships for both our personal and professional lives. And I think, look, we've become fearful of hugging, shaking hands, touching in general. And I don't think we quite understand how this year of distance and isolation may affect our psyches and the very nature of human relationships over the long term. And what we do know is that, you know, given this slow march of vaccinations around the world, I mean, our Operation Warp Speed is far slower than warp speed at this point. We're not going to go simply snap back to normal, to the world of physical normalcy anymore. This way of life, you know, supported by what 20 years ago, when we were talking about beige boxes earlier today, this type of technology was science fiction like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's now part of our culture. And I think for here, it's here to stay for better and for worse.
Okay, I want to discuss this more and with our listeners as well, because you touched on some very interesting points. We only have 5 minutes left, and I want to give others a chance to give their ideas. Walter, go ahead. You're muted, I think. Yeah, you definitely, we're not getting audio from you, so try again. Okay, Kyle, how about you?
Well, I think definitely electron microscopy and the gene sequencing, stuff that has been around for a while, was like an indispensable tool in working around the clock to speak in a collaborative way and to share what the scientific community was learning, and in a really, really rapid way. And I think that's mind-boggling, and I don't think we've really been able to look back and appreciate yet how important that is and was, but will be in the future. And I think the ability to develop things quickly and respond will lead to a lot more important, and we will realize how essential that kind of research and development is to humanity going forward. And this is going to be the kind of protocol in the future. I'm not, I don't doubt at all. And so I think that's definitely how technology, one of the major ways we saw technology, stuff that we'd been using in different ways, really take off. And I think at the more sort of everyday level for most people, the normalization, and this kind of speaks to what Gia was saying, is video conferencing becoming something we commonly understand, the divide, all the different types of platforms, the etiquette and behaviors around that. I think they're not all the way there. We're still learning how to make best use of this technology, but the understanding of it as a tool, I think, is emerging, and that's exciting in how it has been able to bridge what has been a really isolated time.
Okay, Voltaire, got the microphone figured out?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Go ahead. Go ahead. Do you have something?
You're muted again.
Oh,
you're...
my God. All right, Rob, how about you?
Okay, the thing I've noticed is that we've all been trapped in our rooms, our houses, our households, whatever, with reduced exposure to other people, if any at all. And I'm a great believer in online community and the power of it, but I'm also seeing kind of a darker edge to it, because everyone is on such a shorter fuse these days. We're all stressed. We're all suffering mental health effects from what's going on. And in the sphere of online forums, comment sections, things like that, everyone just seems so much more prone to flying off the handle and going nuts and maybe arguing about why they don't want to wear a mask or things like that. I'm finding that some bits of the internet have become a significantly darker place through the pandemic. And I'm still a great believer in online community and its ability to bring people together in positive ways. But we also all have to work extra hard to remember the person behind the keyboard on the other end and kind of temper what we do.
Boy, you're giving me so much to think about and talk about. I'm looking forward to overtime. 8 o'clock, YouTube, channel 2600. Voltaire, one last chance. Is your microphone working?
Yes.
Okay, you have about a minute.
Has been the failure of things like contact tracing apps that policymakers have tried to promote them as things that will make up for a lack of healthcare services, basically, and actual employees that do contact tracing full time as their job. But I think it also goes for like remote learning, when so many people don't even have internet access, especially in urban area, poverty stricken areas. You can't use these technologies as a quick fix to make up for lack of basic social services.
Well said. All right. We are going to head out of here for now. It is, as I said, our last show of 2020. And we are reflecting on what has happened in this historic year. We're also reflecting on what the future holds. Join us on YouTube, channel 2600. We'll see you there. Good night. Culture.
nations rise and fall. I've heard their stories, heard them all. But love's the only engine of survival. Your servant here, he has been told to say it clear, to say it cold. It's over, it ain't going any further. And now the wheels of heaven stop. You feel the devil's riding crop. Get ready for the future. It is murder. Fine.